tears you apart and then some. When you miss someone.
Good Friday morning, folks, and if you're listening, you and you're hearing that song by
Ellie Goulding.
I've only played it 1,000 times. How long will I love you? As you know, it's my commitment to the folks out there on the street. And today we have a not such a great day. The temperature is not bad at 14, a little bit cool, but it's also raining, so. Be extra kind today when you're going to Tim's, buy an extra coffee or steep tea or going to Starbucks. And I always say, if you can afford to go to Starbucks, you can afford to buy two. So buy an extra coffee for someone on the street. And you are listening to CKUW 95.9 FM, your community radio station right here at the University of Winnipeg. And and thank you for joining us on this long weekend Friday. Today, I have a very special guest, a person I admire very, very much. And we've been trying to, we've been just kind of misconnecting on getting Bradley West on the air. But we finally made it happen today. And as it is Pride Month, and he's a staunch advocate for, and that's not, maybe that's the word, maybe it's not, for Pride, and I thought it was really appropriate, as among so many other things that Bradley does. I got to know him through the Human Rights Committee Council, I think.
Yes.
But Bradley, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Al, for having me, and I'm really glad that we're able to make it work. And yes, my schedule in the month of June was a little bit sticky, shall we say.
And mine as well. And I think I canceled on us one time, postponed our conversation one time as well. So, but we're here now. And as I do with every guest, I just ask a brief history, where you come from, and what drives you today. What is your and how you got to the place where you are today. And Bradley is the manager of Equity and Diversity, City of Winnipeg, if I am saying that correctly.
Yes,
that and is correct. And so there's a road that leads to that. And so maybe if you want to care to talk about that just a little bit.
Absolutely. So first of all, you know, one of the things that I do like to be able to do whenever having conversation in space and place is look at the treaty acknowledgement and to acknowledge that this conversation we're having today is taking place on Treaty One land.
Thank you for that.
Which are the traditional homelands, the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Dakota peoples. There's also been the Sioux and the Dene. We've had the Navajo, the Inuit coming to this space and place for millennia for not only trade, but ceremony, festivals and celebrations. And we also want to acknowledge that our clean drinking water comes to us in Winnipeg from Treaty 3 from Shoal Lake, and that the traditional guardians and keepers of that water are in Treaty 39 and 40 of Shoal Lake. And I feel that's an important part for me to do because I am an immigrant. I am a settler. I've been in this country now for like 33 years. But I'm also the children of immigrants and settlers who themselves were children and grandchildren of immigrants and settlers. And so that diaspora journey around the globe and what it brings in terms of both the benefits but also concessions and challenges, I think is something I've always tried to acknowledge, not only my own individual journey but now collectively, especially here in what we call Canada and Turtle Island, when we look into reconciliation. And the first part of that is truth.
Yes.
And truth telling has always been something that has resonated with me in my journey. First in my own family, like many people who may be listening, I grew up into a family that had a fair amount of dysfunction and trauma, like so many families of the 70s did. You know, they were children of systems that built trauma into how they were raised. And with all of that, I saw that, you know, my family wasn't like other families, and I wanted to know why. And I was asking questions and, of course, being told, don't talk about that. It's in the past. You don't talk about these things. And I was one of the sort of earlier truth tellers in the family, if you will, of like trying to find out how did we get to where we were? Why was it creating the family dynamics we had? And, you know, that opened up the door to those conversations. And that then helped me find my own path forward in terms of recognizing the truths about myself, right? So one of the things very early on in my life that I recognized was that I was attracted more to boys than I was girls. I'd always felt different, even when I was like 4 or 5 and 6. You know, I went to a boys' school for a while, Catholic boys' school, and I never was able to connect to the other boys. I never felt like I was part of the group. I always felt like I was on the outside. And then as I got older and puberty clicked in and I kept waiting for the girl thing to happen, which everybody said would, and it didn't. And then that got me starting to question the stories that were being told, because not only was I seeing these disconnects in my family unit, right? So I was born into a fairly affluent family, and while on the outside we looked like, you know, the picture perfect home, it was not. You know, my first stepfather, he was an alcoholic. He was the byproduct of trauma. He was born in a prisoner of war camp, a Japanese internment camp during Second World War, and so the first 6 years of his life was incredibly traumatic. His family were forced out of Russia during the revolution, so they had cycles of trauma and pain and loss, and they had no language on how to process that trauma, pain, and loss. And then they were evicted through war and relocated into Australia through the Red Cross to be part of the diaspora Russian community. So this intergenerational traumatizing from the systems of colonization, which benefited us in many ways economically and socially because we're at the top of the hierarchy, right? Particularly in our country and in my state, you know, I was born into a white family. We were Christian. We were the right denomination. We were Catholic. When Australia was colonized, each of the Christian churches got a state. So the Catholic Church got Queensland.
You just taught me something new.
So it was like an formal thing, like the Anglicans got New South Wales, the Presbyterians and the Baptists got Victoria, and the Salvation Army got the rest of it because nobody really wanted it. They weren't terribly interested, but the Salvation Armies, the Salvos, they'd go anywhere, right? And so not only was I, you know, the right religion, I was the right skin color, mm-hmm. we were affluent, you know, we were the sons of the empire, if mm-hmm. you can recall those phrases from the mm-hmm. 40s, 50s, and 60s. And so the system that had been crafted was working very well for my family in a lot of ways, but not in other ways too. Mm-hmm. So my mom did something that was very scandalous for her generation in the early 70s. She decided that the rules that she had lived by were not serving her so well, mm-hmm. and she left my birth father. So that is not something that affluent, well-bred Catholic women did at mm-hmm. the time. They didn't initiate divorces, particularly in that cultural narrative at the time. There were some movements happening in Europe and in England, but Australia was still very conservative. Mm-hmm. You know, when my mum left my birth dad and got divorced, women couldn't have a credit card in their own name. Mm. She still needed a man to be able to co-sign for a bank account.
Wow.
You know, the level of social acceptance of domestic violence, intimate partner family violence, and patrilineal family violence was very high. Like I said, I went to a boys' school for a small amount of time. My brothers all went through that school. This was a Catholic school run by the mm-hmm. Jesuit brothers. And like many Catholic schools, there was a lot of trauma being inflicted on the students in that school. Mm-hmm. And these were white students who were Christian, whose parents were paying a large amount of money for their children to be in that facility. And they were still being regularly physically disciplined, caning till they bled or bruised, humiliated. There are stories of, you know, family members having yeah. to stand in trash cans and repeat, "I am garbage, I am rubbish." So years later, when I started to hear about the traumas of residential school, mm-hmm.
it resonated.
Right. It absolutely resonated. But I also never doubted for a single moment the veracity or the truth of the stories being told. Mm-hmm. Because it was not so much of a leap for me to think about what horror could be unleashed upon a person that they saw as less than.
Of course.
If they looked at this person and they saw them as a savage, they saw them as pagan, as yeah. heathen.
Right.
You know, all of the language that those of us who have read the survivor stories from the Truth and Reconciliation Journey have heard repeated. Mm-hmm. I had no trouble believing them because I saw what the nuns and priests were capable of doing mm-hmm. to Catholics, mm-hmm. to white Catholics, to affluent yeah. white Catholics who were the children of pillars of their community. You know, my mom was nominated as Catholic Woman of the Year once by the same archbishop who threatened her with excommunication when she left my birth dad. And my mom had over her office desk for many years, the letter nominating her as Catholic Woman mm-hmm. of the Year for our state, and then the note, the handwritten note from the bishop threatening her with excommunication.
What a dichotomy.
And she would always say, it's the same woman, different perspective.
Yes.
So the power of perspective, the power of story, of how people relate to different people in systems had been part of my early journey. I had mentioned that I was born into a fairly affluent family. When my mum remarried, my first stepfather was very violent. He was the one who grew up with trauma. He was an alcoholic, he was an mm-hmm. addict, he was a gambler, very abusive mm-hmm. emotionally, psychologically yeah. in all ways. And I understood that you could be both a victim and a victimizer. You could be both the oppressed and the oppressor.
Yes.
Because my mother, who was incredibly confident and powerful in the business realm and had built a large, successful series of businesses in male-dominated areas and confronted sexism, was then also unable to break away from this person for a very long time. And when we finally did leave, when I was 9 or 10, we were bankrupt. He had stolen everything through forging of documents, stealing of information, and of course, the sexism of the day. So for example, if my mom was withdrawing any money, more than, you know, a few dozen dollars from their joint bank account, the bank manager would always give a courtesy call to her husband just to make sure that he knew, mm-hmm. oh, by the way, she's in here and she's got a check for $100. Mm. That's okay, right? But there was never, ever a courtesy call when he came in on his own and with documents signed by my mom, withdrew tens of thousands of dollars of capital from mm. trust funds set mm. up in my name and in her name, I mean the business names. There was never a courtesy call for, oh, he's in today for the fourth time and this week and he's liquidated like $100,000. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. On joint accounts. Mm. So that type of sexism, that type of turning a blind eye, impacted my family in a very real visceral way. Mm-hmm. So for a time we were homeless. We had nowhere to stay and we were couch surfing. Now, our friends were affluent as well. So couch surfing when you're affluent is a little bit different mm-hmm. than couch surfing when you're not. Mm-hmm. But that tenuous relationship to realizing that money could go away, and also realizing how my mum and the people around us talked about what was happening without acknowledging what was happening. And I remember once talking to my mum and saying, well, where did it all go? And she was like, well, it's gone. And I was like, well, get it back, the money. And she was like, well, it's not that simple. And she said, you know, and I was like, well, this is not good. Where I don't like being poor. And she just looked at me and she said, we are not poor. And she said, we have a cash flow problem. She said, our family is not poor. We never have been, nor will we ever be poor. Poverty is a state of mind.
Mm.
And she said, and we are not poor. You must understand that. Do not tell anyone that we're poor.
Mm.
Years later, I also understood that there was an element of fear in that.
Mm-hmm.
Because what my mum was also saying was that if those who are supporting us understand how little we have, it would change how they related to us, how we were connected to them.
Without a doubt.
And so, you know, my queerness and that example of that, and then watching my mum rebuild the finances of the family through hard work and, you know, all of the things she did over the next decades, of finding her reunite with one of her early loves, who she was originally engaged to when she was a teenager, and them building together a life and spending the next 35 years of their life together. It just taught me the power of space and place and the power of story individually and collectively. Mm-hmm. So I kind of got into that role of story changing. And, you know, that helped me be able to eventually come to terms with my queerness and then move into the community to be able to build connections and relationships. Volunteerism had always been very important in my family. Public service had always been very important in my family. And so naturally, when I found myself separating from my spouse at the time and coming out and having to leave my church community and all those things, which were absolutely necessary to do at the time, I reached out to the Rainbow Resource Center, which was then the Gay and Lesbian Resource Center, because I didn't know anyone here. I was an immigrant. The only family I had were connected to who was going to be my ex-partner.
Yes.
So they weren't terribly keen on having a relationship with me. I had been thrown out of my church and told on no certain terms that I was not welcome there anymore because I was now embracing the reality of who I was. So I had no friends. I had no family here. And I had to start from scratch, from square one, literally. You know, left the family home because that's where my daughter was, right? And wasn't going to disrupt that. So that's where they were going to live. And so having to find a new place and all those types of different things. And the Gay and Lesbian Resource Center really was my gateway, not only to building friendships and relationships, but a sense of community as well. And it was through them that I got involved with Pride. They were hosting, you know, the Pride planning committees at the time, and they had asked, you know, do you have any skills? And I'm like, well, what do they need? And they're like, well, if you want to organize the march, you can do that. And I laughed. I'm like, oh, I can totally do that. They're like, what? I was like, yeah, I helped organize the March for Jesus for a couple of years.
Yeah.
I'm like, and they laughed. That was the same response. And I said, it's essentially the same thing. I went, you have flags, you have music, you're marching to celebrate what you believe.
So let me get this straight. You are the founder of the parade?
No. So I helped to organize the March for Jesus.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And the Pride parades had been happening for about 10 years.
Oh, so Hillary, okay.
I watched my first Pride parade in 1995, but the first one that I helped to organize was in 96.
Awesome.
And so I was on the Pride committee from 96 until 2008. And so I organized the rally.
So you're the guy to speak to on this.
Yeah. So I organized the rally and the march for a long time. I like to use the term march. I know a lot of people now use the term Pride Parade because of the celebratory nature of that. Personally, for me, I still use the word march because it is still a radical political statement.
Yes.
It is also still a radical declaration of self-love, self-healing, and self-care.
And march adds a little bit of oomph, adds a little bit of something.
Absolutely, yeah. It does. And I know there are some people who use them interchangeably who talk about the march and parade, right? Mm-hmm. Helped organize that, and then I helped organize the dance for a number of years mm-hmm. as well, and then was co-chair and co-president. Mm. I was also, through my relationship with Pride here in Winnipeg, mm-hmm. got involved with InterPride, which is the International Association of Pride Festivals. Wow. So I represented our region, which was Region 7 at InterPride, because it straddled Canada and the United States. And I was part of the conversations to mm-hmm. be able to create the Canadian Pride organization, so Fierty Canada Pride. And was humbled enough to be elected their inaugural president, and then served as inaugural president for the first 2-year term, and then helped the next president with their 2-year term.
Yeah, so you're the perfect person to have to talk about this. I had no idea. I mean, you learn something new every day. Well, congratulations on all that work, but it's come through. You've got there by walking through fire.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that, if you talk to any community activist or advocate, mm. they've all got their own lived
yes.
experience.
Yep.
They've all got their own touchstone story of what brought them forward. Yes. And because I was born into affluence and into mm-hmm. those positions of privilege, if you will, in our society, mm-hmm. it never occurred to me that I wasn't welcome in space mm-hmm. and place.
Right.
And so that I just carried that through once I came out. And, I had seen and knew and experienced how people related to me when they saw me as a white Christian heterosexual male.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was able to clock the difference when they were responding to me as a white queer. Male.
And again, back in that period of time, it was...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the late 90s, people were still being fired here mm-hmm. in this city for coming out, especially those who are in a professional role. So teachers, mm-hmm. Nurses, doctors, lawyers, social workers, mm-hmm. Anyone in the caring professions or chartered profession, it was very, very
totally
dangerous
taboo.
To come out.
Yes.
Yeah, there were definitely still real-time costs that were involved.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my husband was one of the first educators in his school division to come out.
Mm.
And he was supported in his community and by his administrators. But not everybody in the community was happy. After Pride 1 year, he ended up on the front page of the Winnipeg Sun, because at that point, the Sun was really the only paper that would cover mm-hmm. Pride on their front page. And it was always coming from a salacious point of view with the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
A Winnipeg Free Press would have it on page 2 and 3, but it was never mm-hmm. front page for mm-hmm. a while. And there was a picture of him.
To have a salacious perspective or aspect of it is just even twice as bad.
Well, it is, in some ways. Yeah. But what was really interesting was that, he was one of many people in the picture, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't just him.
Yeah,
it was a group of educators who were marching, I believe. Anyway, what happened was that he came to school early one morning, as he always would. He rode to work on a bike.
Mm-hmm.
And someone in the community had photocopied the front page of that newspaper. Mm-hmm. And had covered every single window and every single door in his school. And they had pink washed it.
Ooh.
And they had written the word faggot on the paper. So he arrived just as the janitor was trying to take them down. And it was the janitor, and the janitor looked at him and was like, don't worry, we'll clean this all up. And then his administrator arrived, and his administrator was like, we're on this, what do you need? They were fully supportive.
Whoa.
They had a meeting with community members that evening, mm-hmm. Parents, and they were like, we will find out who did this, but we want to be very clear. This is not appropriate. We're fully supportive of him. And if any of you have a problem or concern, you can come and talk to the administration.
That was kind of a turning point. It was really a different perspective, I think, than what they were expecting.
I think the person who did this was probably expecting, embarrassment, pain, shame, humiliation.
Maybe a firing.
Yeah. And it didn't happen. But it was also very disconcerting for a while for not only, my husband, but also for his colleagues and his co-workers, and even for parents in the community, because they're looking around and they were all like, who amongst us would do that? because it had to be someone who not only knew the environment but knew the layout of the school and all those types of things, who were intimately involved with the school.
Inside job.
Yeah, and also they had a small window of time because there was stuff happening at the school the day before, so there were people at the school until like 2 or 3 in the morning, and so they only had like a 3-hour window, because you know, when they got there at 6, it was already up.
Whoa.
So, you know, today we hear about pride flags being burnt, and we hear about those types of things that are happening again. Unfortunately, these are not new to the community, but what is scary, no matter when it happens, is the realization that there are people in our community who find our presence and our visibility so confronting and affronting to them personally that they feel emboldened to do these types of actions. The other thing is that, as my mother always used to say, you show me someone with the courage of their conviction, I will show you someone I can have a conversation with. But she said, cowards have no courage of conviction. She said, there is no bravery in the nighttime fruiting.
Right.
There is no bravery in wearing a mask and walking down the street.
Right.
There is no bravery in covering yourself up and then, you know, going online and you, as an anonymous person, you know, kitty cat 769 with a sunset emoji, having all these virulent things. So to me, I feel like a lot of the folks who do this aren't as committed as they like to think they are. I think for me, my experience of individuals like that, I've had some conversations with people who have done those types of things. At the end of the day, they're very afraid and they're feeling like they are powerless in their own life, and this gives them a moment of action. You know,
right, folks, you're listening to of No Fixed Address right here at CKUW 95.9 FM at the University of Winnipeg. We're just going to take a short music break, but come back and hear more interesting dialogue with our good friend Bradley West. Thank you so much for coming in today and sharing. Stay tuned. Come back in about 2 minutes. Thanks.
With you and slept with you, your boy.
And we are back with Of No Fixed Address, your show on advocacy. And today we have a really special person talking about the human rights of, and we'll get into that a little bit, on human rights of LGBTQ and LGBTQ2S folks. And very informative. You know, we sat down at the Free Press Cafe when I had lunch there one day, and my mind was just blown away by your knowledge. Like, this gentleman is an encyclopedia. <You know? laughs> And I knew that you know, there was so much to talk about with you, and you know, we need to have that talk again, because I just, you know, every time we talk, I learn something. And it's really special having a conversation with you. And today, we're talking about everything from Australia's form of government and the discrimination and the world there, and what people have faced here.
Mm-hmm.
How much do you feel? I mean, the government has done a few things, but how much do you feel, you know, they've fallen short by a million miles, but what do you think the government can do more to erase the discrimination against, you know, people, LGBTQ folks? Or do you think that it's an issue?
Obviously, there is still issues of, you know, whether it's a discrimination around race and ethnicity. Mm-hmm. We look at people, mobility challenges, discrimination. Mm-hmm. I think one of the realities that has really clicked into my mind in the last couple of years is the recognition that we have systems that are no longer fit for purpose.
Mm-hmm.
One of the challenges of our government is that, you know, our government is doing exactly what it was designed to do, mm-hmm. right? Our governments were never designed to be proactive. Our governments were always designed to be reactive.
Yes.
When I say our government,
that's interesting.
I'm talking about the Commonwealth governments, yes. So constitutional monarchies, mm-hmm. like ours.
Yeah.
That is different than a republic like our neighbors to the south. And mm-hmm. we're having that chat in the break,
yes.
about the fact that a lot of people forget that the United States is a republic.
Mm-hmm.
They're not a democracy. Those two things are different. They have a lot of democratic elements to mm-hmm. them, but they are a republic. They're not a constitutional monarchy. Canada is. It's part of the Commonwealth. And the right. Canadian system, the Westminster system, it's been around for about 600 years in one way, shape, or form. And it was always designed to be reactive to the will of the crown mm-hmm. and the will of the people. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about the people, we also have to remember who those people were historically. It was the same people that were reflected in the, you know, the Declaration of Independence.
Yes. Yeah.
And it was white landowners who were male.
Mm-hmm.
That's who the people were at the time. When we said we the people, there was very clear reference of white people who owned land, and a good size amount of land too, not mm-hmm. just like a strip of land.
Yeah.
You had to own a chunk. At that point, you also had to own slaves.
Mm.
And
isn't it interesting that now sector are trying to erase the history of slavery?
Oh, absolutely. Because a lot of people find it an inconvenient truth.
Yes.
Just
yes,
as they're
exactly
trying
it.
To erase the history of residential schools.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are still elected people in this space and place who have the audacity to say that residential schools weren't all that bad for everybody.
We had
as
that,
if
we had
they
that
had a choice
yes.
of being there. Like, these children were forcibly taken out of their homes, out of their communities. So the moment you force anyone to be anywhere,
mm-hmm.
whatever benefit, in air quotes, comes to them is completely negated.
Did we not have a senator, a woman senator? That
We've had a number of elected people
that,
who have
that
made
really
those
spoke
statements.
Up, you know, in disbelief of
yeah.
Of the residential school system.
And that goes back to the stories we have been told, right? And so when I think about the role that governments can play, one of the things that we have to start having those conversations about at that high level of power mm-hmm. is that the present governmental system isn't going to produce the roles or the responsibilities or the outcomes that we, the mm-hmm. citizens, have come to believe in.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people now do believe in the application of human rights. They do want, you know, the Declaration of Human Rights to be the supreme law,
mm-hmm.
when it is not. It yeah. is not the supreme law, not in this country or in any yeah. of the countries. Also remember that even the idea of human rights is a relatively new one in terms of our collective experience. Mm-hmm. You know, the Declaration of Human Rights came out of the UN just after the Second World War.
Yes.
If you went back 100 years ago, even 150 years ago, the idea of the individual having rights that were theirs just from the element of being born was absolutely laughable. Like, no one in any position of authority would have trucked with that at all. They would have just been like, oh, well, then great, and let's have, you know, the sky be made out of toffee apples, shall we? So yes. We have come a huge way in a very short amount of time. And I think that, you know, what we need to be able to do to help our politicians be braver is we need to support brave politicians.
Yes.
We need to also understand that they have systems that aren't going to produce the results that we want. Mm. So we have to change the system.
Yeah.
So we have to let them know that it's going to take courage to do that. But that's where we've gotten some of the great
systemic
things.
Systemic change is the hardest thing to do.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we have... one politician who speaks of what you're saying is Leah Kazan. I've had her on the show quite a bit, and I anticipate that she might show up for my little walk tomorrow.
Awesome.
As she usually does. But, you know, it's but we need more. If we had, 50 Leah Kazans in Parliament, we'd be in a lot better shape.
We would. So that means that we, as the individuals, the residents, those who vote, those who come out. So first of all, if you don't vote, I'm sorry, you don't really have a right to have an opinion other than grumble over your coffee or your beverage of choice, right? And I say that because, you know, I come from a country where voting is compulsory. So voting is compulsory in Australia and has been since we started our democracy. So everybody votes. Now, there is an option when you vote for none of the above to let the people know that none of what you all are offering is very good for me, and that's great.
That's a different type of democracy, if that's
so
what you call
you're
it.
You're all having to participate in the conversation because they're like, you know, you can't have 30% of the people making the decision for 100% of the population, which is often what happens in the way that we have our politicians here. So you do need to get involved. You do need to be support your politicians. You also need to look at how we recruit politicians, because if we want more people like Leah Kazan, we want more people like, you know, a Minister Fontaine, a Minister Smith, Wab Kanu. We want more people like, you know, Lisa Naylor, people who are passionate, who are caring, who are committed to social justice and equity. Then we also have to stop treating politicians like they are piñatas and that they are a source of social media entertainment, and we need to know everything about them and their family and their family's family, because what that does is it exposes them to a level of vitriol that us as individual people would be insanely uncomfortable with enduring. So we have these thresholds, and what that then means is that the type of people who self-select into that and then the types of people who stay in that are generally the types of people who aren't terribly empathic.
Entirely.
Right?
Yeah,
they have to be to survive and thrive.
I like the piñata analogy.
Right?
Right. My head's so full. I'm going to be thinking about this for a couple of days, and we're going to have you back on.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to.
But talk to me about your role with the city in equity and diversity, because that ties right in. I mean, you're the perfect guy for the job. It ties right in.
Thank you. So, yes, my role right now at the city, I've been with the city for almost 2 years, is the manager of equity, diversity, and inclusion in the equity office. Relatively new role for the city, and also a relatively new division. So the equity office was created as a result of the equity, diversity, and inclusion strategy that was passed by council in 2021, the fall of 2021. And between 2020 and 2021, a city council did a number of initiatives designed at building a more inclusive sense of belonging within the fabric of Winnipeg as a city. So we have the newcomer welcome and inclusion strategy and policy, the poverty reduction strategy, the EDI strategy and policy. We have the Indigenous Accord. So all of these are working together to create
The HRCC.
Yes, and so the HRCC, Human Rights Committee of Council, mm-hmm. where we're one of the only councils that has a Human Rights Committee attached to it within the council structure.
Right.
So all of these things look at the systemic change. So currently, due to resourcing, the Equity Office is internal facing, which means that we focus on City of Winnipeg employees, current employees.
Okay.
But we have strong relationship with the community facing departments and divisions like the Indigenous Relations Division, Community Support Services, and those types of things.
You are involved in a few external. You have events that you take part in quite a bit as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, we try to show up and be not only the face of the city, mm-hmm. but also to build those relationships with community organizations, because we understand that the types of system changes we're talking about are going to involve all of us working together, mm-hmm. leveraging existing resources, looking at where is any replication of effort, and if it is, mm-hmm. you know, bring those together, but also to support each other in the work, because whether you are advocating for change around 2SLGBTQ folks, mm-hmm. or trying to get more resources for people who are unsheltered, mm-hmm. or for people who are experiencing a health crisis, whether that's a mental health crisis, mm-hmm. or an embodied health crisis, the one thing that we understand is that advocacy on your own is exhausting, and there's a huge amount of emotional labor required.
Tell me about it.
Absolutely. So we have to come together, and we have to look at not only the systemic issues so that it is sustainable, mm-hmm. but we also have to look at centering those lived experience voices and then honoring them and mm-hmm. compensating them to be able to say, hey, you do have that level of expertise.
Yes.
You are valued as part of this process. How can we move together? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that goes to those changes that do need to happen, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the duality of the fact that, you know, Canada has done fairly well in a lot of areas when you look at legal protections for 2SLGBTQ folks. And, you know, even in terms of multiculturalism has mm-hmm. done fairly well in some areas, but has fallen short in so many other areas as well. And it's that recognition of where we have fallen short. And if that is our stated goal, let's go there. And if it is not our stated goal, that's where politicians have to have some bravery and say, that sounds really good, but that's not the goal right now. The goal right now, the priority right now is this. We can't get to that. Let the people know, you know, we're not going to fall into a heap and be destroyed. I think that transparency is what a lot of folks are looking for.
And that is hard to find sometimes.
Absolutely, because we haven't historically rewarded transparency, right? We have whistleblower legislation, and then we punish the whistleblowers. Mm-hmm. We have people who come forward and share their truth, and then we drag them through the mm-hmm. coals to find any inconsistencies.
Right.
Whether it is the person who is doing the whistleblowing, whether it's somebody who's been victimized, or whether it's somebody who's observed something.
Right.
So we're still having this visceral involvement with these stories as if they are entertainment, and they are not. And that has not been a new issue. I mean, if you go back even when looking at when the printing press first started, right?
Mm-hmm.
The written word was so powerful that they ended up having to control who had access, because people would absolutely believe anything that was written.
Mm-hmm.
And there were even people who did stuff to test that experiment out in like the 1700s who would write one thing one week and the complete opposite the next. And the same people would believe it, right? Because mm-hmm. the power of the written word at that point was so linked to authoritative truth.
I know you had a series, and I'm not sure you're still continuing that, but I know you worked together with HRCC and put together a speaker series.
Absolutely.
I was really honored to be part of that. And again, you just talk about the stories, but you know, I think that role or doing that and putting different diverse stories out there.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's really, really important just to open hearts and minds, right?
Yes. We actually had an event yesterday with the speaker series. So mm-hmm. it's the Action and Awareness Speaker Series. Mm. And our listeners can find it. Go on to winnipeg.ca.
Yes, I was going to ask
look for
that.
The Human Rights Committee. Mm-hmm. And then you can find the links. We have through the city YouTube channel, mm-hmm. a lot of those up there. So we had Dr. Yosef Soufi yesterday talking about the trials and failures, the challenges around multiculturalism.
Right.
He was specifically looking at it through the lens of Islamophobia.
Yes.
But then he was also able to tie it to what are the limitations of multiculturalism from the Canadian government lens and from a theory lens, and what can we do to be able to let it live up to the promise?
You know, that series is looked at right across the country. I've received speaking engagements from Vancouver because I did that particular.
Yes.
I mean, you have a lot of reach.
Oh, we do. We have a number of organizations in Manitoba who use the series as part of their ongoing professional development.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday with Dr. Yosef Soufi, he had academics joining from all across the country.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we had, you know, we've had people join in from Nunavut. We've had folks come in from, you know, Prince Edward Island.
That was another thing. I was in Yellowknife a few weeks ago, and the same thing came up.
Yeah. Right? So all you need really is access to a device and a stable internet connection,
yes,
which I know for many people can be a high threshold within and of itself.
Yeah.
But that's why we do have it on the YouTube channel, so it's available 24/7. So if you're in a public library or facility, you can always look at those ones.
Again, I know you're really connected to the Human Rights Committee Council, and I serve 6 years, and I am going back in August because you know I need to be that voice for the people on the street. To date I was the only one that was creating a noise about it, and again, we were talking about the human rights issue, and again, it's new, and this was a creation of the former mayor, about 7 years ago.
Absolutely,
and,
yes.
And I know that you're almost every meeting. You showed up and you had a voice there.
Well, yes, I have a formal role there in that I do verbal updates on the Action and Speak Awareness series.
Yeah.
And there were also a number of strategies and policies that the Human Rights Committee of Council had either touched on or wanted to be updated on.
Mm-hmm.
So a number of those strategies and policies would go through the Equity Office.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I'm at the meetings to give that verbal update. But the public service full-time representative there is my director, Angie Cousin.
Yes,
who's the director.
I really appreciate Angie as well.
Yes. So Angie is like the full-time representative of the public service, and she is the director of human resources and the Equity Office there. So the relationship between that committee and the public service is a strong relationship, absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. And, and again, it just goes to sometimes forgotten human rights issues between LGBTQ folks and if I can use that term.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've got intersectionality, and you know,
there's the word right there.
You know, and for those who are familiar with the word, you know, coming from Kimberly Cranshaw, the academic scholar, that term has now grown beyond the initial articulation in a really good way, and I know that. It's a powerful tool because it lets us look at the interconnections.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that is shifting and changing is that we're realizing that human rights issues are not separate and distinct from economic development and are not separate and distinct from being a desirable place to live and invest in. For too long, we've had this isolation and siloization of, well, you have economic development and then you have human rights, as if these two things are antithetical and they compete with each other. That's not the case at all. It's like when you look at human rights, a lot of people initially were looking at it as a pie, and if I give rights to somebody else, I lose rights for myself. It's like, no, it's not a pie. We're building a bigger pie. We're making a bigger cake. You're not getting less. We're actually making it more. We're expanding the tent. And when we center human rights and build that sense of inclusion and belonging, everyone will thrive. Businesses do better. People feel more engaged. They're more connected. They're less likely to be radicalized.
Yes.
They're less likely to commit crime. They're less likely to fall through the cracks and feel like nobody sees me or listens to me. And in those moments of desperation, people will then act out in ways that are often very painful, very dangerous, and they don't have care and concern for other people because no care and concern has ever been shown for them.
Right. you speak with a profound knowledge. When we sat down at the Winnipeg Free Press the Free Press Cafe, we talked about right to housing. We don't have time to get into that.
Right.
We'll deal with that in another program.
Absolutely.
But I was so taken by your knowledge of the right to housing, and it's it's one of those things that should be at the top of everybody's list, because the homeless issue in our country is it's a crisis situation.
Absolutely. And yet again, it's not a new issue when you think about the shanty towns.
It's been going on hundreds of years.
Exactly. You had the shanty towns after the Depression in the 30s and 40s. Mm. In Australia, they were absolutely thriving in most areas up until the Second World War.
Right.
In fact, I remember going through some archives and seeing people's birth records from the 20s and the 30s from Australia, and it's like born by the East Side Rail track, Track 3, the one with the corrugated roof. And that was where people went.
Yeah.
And, social services went there and gave them their social services. Mm-hmm. There was no conversation about they should not be living in the shanty.
Yeah.
It was like, this is where we went to them.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of, again, human rights is relatively new to us as a human family in our history. And what does that mean? And so if we're looking at housing as a right, which still hasn't been agreed upon from a legal perspective, and also from a social perspective, individually people say, yes, people should be able to live, but where do they live and how do they live and what does that look like? That's still very much open for debate. But how people get to these elements that allow them to express the fullness of their humanity, the fullness of their dignity, has often been looked at through the lens of the private sector.
Oh, and too much, actually.
Well, way too much. And, that was part of the problem here with housing in Canada was that when, the federal government got out of, say, looking at housing development in the 70s. Late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah,
and they were like, this is a provincial issue. They moved to the provinces.
Yes.
Provinces were all overwhelmed. So they didn't get any extra money. So they were like, we're just going to put this down to the cities and the developers.
1990,
1991, it ended. And then it came out, and then housing became a way of investing. And the moment it became a way to build your capital, your individual wealth, which property always has
been. Right now it's happening way too often. We have billions in unoccupied spaces right across this country.
We do, but we always have. Right? Yeah. We've always had the idea of wealthy people using land as a base for their wealth and their autonomy and power.
Right.
Go back to medieval Europe, and the way that you got power was land and who owned the land and how people lived on the land, right? One of the things my mum always used to say was, always buy land. God isn't making any more, right? What we have is what we've got. And at some point, this will be valuable, right? She was like, all you have to do is wait. And there's a truth in that in terms of the resources we have are the resources we have. So how are we using them? What makes sense? One of the things that I have been really emboldened and happy by was looking at...
We'll have to end pretty soon. We're going to have you back.
I'd love to be back.
Let's talk right to housing next time, because you just kind of filled my head that particular day at lunch. You filled my head with all kinds of ideas. And, we're going to involve you again next year in the symposium.
Fantastic. It's amazing work that you're doing, Al, to bring not only advocacy and visibility to this issue, but different people who have a small piece of the solution puzzle, and you bring them together.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And that's incredibly powerful, because we all realize, I have this little piece, you have that piece, you piece, and then suddenly it's like, well, here's a solution we've been looking at for 5 years. Where did that all come from? Because we're all together and we agreed, everyone agreed this needs to be solved.
Yeah. That's it. But thank you so much for coming on today. Any last words for our listeners? You could talk for another 2 hours on this, but any last words?
I think I've always, when you're looking at either human rights for people who are towards LGBTQ or anyone is to understand of the relationship between the personal and the political,
right,
but to also delineate the difference between collective and individual responsibility. So I love what you had said, like, when you're out today, buy an extra coffee. If you see someone out there on the street, even if you can't help them, sometimes the best thing
don't
to do
is... don't make them invisible.
Yeah, exactly. Smile. Connect to them.
Yes.
Ask them how their day is going, right? Extend that kindness because it won't cost you anything.
Right. Next week we're going to have just a bit of a turn. The next 2 weeks are kind of planned already. We're going to have Raphael from Voxtel Construction, who's the community service. You know, he does a lot of work with nonprofits, and he's a really interesting gentleman. Him and I have coffee like once every 3 weeks. And we're going to have him talking about, the role of private enterprise in nonprofits. And how they can actually make a difference.
Absolutely.
And the week after, we're going to talk to the issue of child poverty and youth homelessness with I can't remember the name of the organization in North End, and they deal a lot with youth exiting child and family services,
right,
which is a huge, huge, huge issue, right?
Absolutely.
And so the next 2 weeks are going to be really informative and entertaining, if I can use that term. Or informative is probably the right word. But nobody's more informative than Bradley West, my guest today.
Oh, gosh, I wouldn't say that. That's a bit of a spin, but thank you very much.
You give
That's
me so much
kind.
To think about every time we speak. But folks, come back next week, and we'll have another good show for you. But... today it's raining. Be extra kind today. You know, give somebody something warm to drink. And again, it's going to be nice all weekend, supposedly. But, you know, it's not always nice when you got to spend 24/7 out on the street. I speak from experience. And let's be kind. And we'll see you all next week.
To see to it that I don't lose you.